It is the State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we talk about co-ops. A co-op, in essence, is a business organized, owned, and controlled by the people who use its services. We explore what cooperatives are advocating for in legislation and in policy initiatives. Join in with your questions and comments about this business model. The number to call in, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Daniel Smith is president and CEO of Cooperative Network. The organization advocates for co-ops in Wisconsin and Minnesota. Dan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with your top legislative priorities this year to improve the economic positions of co-ops in Wisconsin. What would you say?
Well, I think it's the same as it has been for the last couple of years, as we really advocate for the expansion, continued expansion of broadband throughout the state. And the reason that I say that, Kate, is because we know how important broadband is into linking communities together, to linking our population together, and to linking various businesses. So really, we really see that the core is the expansion of broadband that brings communities together, because that's one of the fundamental principles of cooperatives, are bringing communities together.
Yeah, go a little bit further there. With co-ops, how is broadband essential?
Well, our cooperative base in Wisconsin and Minnesota, it stretches border to border. And cooperatives have a long history and heritage of supporting communities through every type of need that the community might have. And when you look at our cooperative membership base, Kate, it's everything from agriculture to energy to healthcare to housing to credit unions, really touches every part of the rural population in both states, as well as parts of the urban population as well. And I think having broadband in effect to help those businesses grow, to provide the goods and services that our rural population and our more remote communities need to prosper and to redevelop after really decades of losing population and losing businesses in those areas. And that's why we always kind of start with that communication tool, that business tool that broadband provides, that can really help these, the revitalization of rural Wisconsin, I think really starts right there. Now, it actually extends beyond that, because obviously we know that broadband isn't the fix for everything. But if we have that in place, then we can move on to all of our other priorities, Kate, such as rebuilding the infrastructure, workforce development. It's really hard to do a workforce development program if you don't have broadband and remote work capability or be able to link businesses together.
It's a building block. Yeah.
Right.
When you represent co-ops in Wisconsin and our neighbor Minnesota, what about the regulatory climate to operating cooperatives? Are there contrasts that you see between Minnesota and Wisconsin?
There are different policies in place and different bills, but actually, it's more similar than you would think, Kate. You know, and I get that question a lot, because Cooperative Network is so diverse. We have, you know, we represent cooperatives from a dozen business sectors in two states. But when we sit down and look at our priorities and the policies in both states, especially in, under the current system, Kate, the current administrations, I should say, in both states. And we have a government affairs director in Minnesota and a government affairs director here in Wisconsin. And we sit down and have those conversations with our team. We're working on very similar platforms. So I think it's more similar than you would anticipate it to be.
We're talking about priorities of the Cooperative Network. Its president and CEO is Dan Smith. You can join in with your questions about co-ops in the different sectors. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. One sector you're very much involved in, one of the largest sectors of you work with, is agriculture. And one concern you say for agriculture co-ops is consolidation in the packing industry. Why is consolidation a concern?
Well, I think we learned some lessons when COVID hit, that consolidation of agricultural production into fewer and fewer hands in the processing industry is a very risky endeavor. What we like to see is diversity in business and population across the rural landscape. And when farmers have to wait a year, sometimes more than that, to get their animals into a processing facility to have that that animal processed, or dairy processing has become more and more consolidated, as has our vegetable processing. Anytime that we see that type of consolidation and specialization in an industry, the risk goes up. So we're very, very pleased that Governor Evers has really invested in his budget the funds needed to really diversify the processing, to add workforce development into those areas, an additional $300,000 per year for grants to the dairy processing. And then, of course, the what you started off with was the meat processing. And we are support the request for an additional $800,000 per year in meat processing grants. That's not only addressing a need from the agricultural side, it's workforce development, it's starting new businesses in rural areas, it's adding to the tax base, and it's responding to an emerging need. And cooperatives have always had a successful record of responding to emerging needs.
Are farmer co-op members more, do they face lower risks? Are they more economically protected in this business model?
I wouldn't say that they're more protected. I think what we're trying to do is to reestablish a diverse system in the processing and agricultural issue network across the state. Risk is inherent in any type of business, whether it's a co-op or a private sector business. There's no magic bullet here. But I do think having the principles of cooperatives guiding a business where the members of the co-op make the decisions, where they elect a board of directors to conduct their business, and the risk and the reward goes back to the members. So obviously, since I said that, there is both risk and reward in starting any type of business like this. So it's a different structure. I think it's one that's been proven to be very valuable over time. Co-ops have such a rich history and heritage in the upper Midwest, everything from agriculture to our energy and on and on. So I think that this is a responding to an emerging need that we really saw during the last couple of years, Kate.
Let's look at credit unions for a moment here. Credit unions being in Wisconsin exempt from state and federal income tax, banks and bank associations are opposing the status. Why do you support credit unions remaining tax exempt?
That issue has come up several times over the last few years and maybe even before that, because cooperatives do not pay cooperative income taxes. But there is a long history behind the cooperative tax status, and it primarily relates to the fact that cooperatives are nonprofit, member-owned, democratically run organizations. That means every member gets a vote. And as I just said a minute ago, every member participates in the risk and the reward of that cooperative. To tax a cooperative would mean double taxation on the members. And that's why we support the credit union status as well as all of the other cooperatives as a nonprofit entity. Cooperative Network is actually structured as a nonprofit cooperative trade association. We are structured exactly as our cooperative members are. And our cooperative members actually provide the resolutions, provide our game plan for what we are going to support and what we are going to oppose. Our members direct our activities. And I believe that's the same for all cooperatives, and that cooperative tax status needs to be protected. And we're engaged in conversations at the Capitol on a regular basis in both states to do so.
Cooperative Network CEO Dan Smith, an organization that is lobbying, working on behalf of co-ops in Wisconsin and Minnesota. Be part of this conversation with a question. You can share your thoughts on the role of cooperatives here in Wisconsin. Call in at 800-642-1234. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Worker-owned cooperatives, they allow people who work at a business to have the majority say in how the company is run and to directly benefit from its success. We explore what cooperatives across Wisconsin are advocating for in state government. Call in with your questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The organization Cooperative Network advocates for co-ops in Wisconsin and Minnesota, and Dan Smith is here, its CEO. Let's bring in Lisa now in Madison. Lisa, hi. What would you like to share?
So, hi, I live in a housing cooperative, and the issue that we have going forward is people that want to buy into the cooperative obtaining mortgages. The bank we were working with was bought out by a bigger bank, and they are no longer accepting our model because when you buy into a cooperative, you're not buying real estate, you're buying shares. And so the suspicion is that AI, since it's taking over so many industries, is not recognizing the cooperative as a viable mortgage or a realistic mortgage. And so we have found a smaller local bank, but, you know, the worry is going forward, we need more options. We need more than one bank where buyers could obtain a mortgage. So hoping that something can be done to help our situation out.
Lisa, thank you. Dan, go ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Lisa. The cooperative housing system has evolved over the years, and the challenge that you bring up, Lisa, we have seen that in the past as well in several different areas. The Minnesota housing cooperative housing system is pretty well advanced, and it's a real good model to watch there. We work very closely with the housing cooperative housing in the Twin Cities, and that issue of protecting your equity in a cooperative housing model continues to come up. We also have worked on other housing models in the past, especially in manufactured housing, which is another evolving need, such as the one that you bring up, Lisa, as how do you protect your investment in a manufactured housing facility if that facility decides to close down. And we've worked on bonding issues for those things. So I think continuing to look at the funding into the cooperative model where equity is not easily defined is a continuing challenge. But I thank you for bringing that up.
Is there an evolution in AI going on here? Is that part of the disruptor?
It could be. And I think we're all learning that almost on a day-to-day basis now, the wide-ranging impact on that. But that is that, and especially along with the consolidation in the finance industry, which Lisa pointed out, of larger and larger banks and the distance growing between the credit institution and the consumer continuing to expand. So keeping that communication open, making sure everyone understands the needs on both sides of that will be very important as we kind of move through this new area.
We continue to hear about that lack of workforce housing, and you see housing co-ops as a way to ease the housing shortage in Wisconsin. Can you explain the connection there? How so?
So cooperatives have this history of responding to emerging needs. So I guess I'd like to expand your question a little bit, Kate, beyond just the housing.
Sure.
So when we look at revitalizing communities, rural or urban, there is no quick fix. But I think because of the cooperative model being involved in so many different sectors, so Lisa brought up the credit part of that, how you get financing and how you protect your equity. So we're working with the cooperative models on the credit end of it. But when we look at a community, it isn't as simple to address like workforce shortages simply by bringing a new employer in. We prefer a more holistic approach, where to revitalize the community, yes, you do need jobs, but you also need housing and cooperative housing units, cooperative manufactured housing units can play a role in that. Cooperative facilities to provide housing for low income families. And then if you have the credit unions addressed, cooperative healthcare. One of the things that I'm really excited about for the cooperative model in the future is, can that cooperative model serve for childcare and elder care, transportation, worker co-ops that were a group of workers who would, you know, rough housing and put in landscaping and those types of things. So very holistic approach all under the cooperative model that can really revitalize communities and provide answers to those emerging needs in that area. Housing is one of them, but healthcare, transportation, credit, energy, all of those things are all part of it.
You have mentioned mobile home parks or manufactured home parks and establishing housing co-ops. What are the barriers there to create co-ops in these places?
Well, we have a great model in Minnesota that we worked very heavily to establish over the last 5 years to a decade. And providing a cooperative development support system to provide affordable housing co-ops. Minnesota just funded a $65 million grant program to preserve and increase manufactured home access. And we're really excited to see how this helps Minnesota rural workers. And we'd like to see something similar in Wisconsin. One of the real benefits of being a two-state organization, Kate, is you can see what works in one state and what doesn't, and then you can adjust. And that's a two-way street. Minnesota's watching Wisconsin, Wisconsin's watching Minnesota. When a mobile home facility closes down, and many of them are because they were built, you know, a half century ago, and some of the infrastructure is really deteriorating. A lot of them are privately owned. It's a tremendous burden on the people who live in that facility, who very often don't have the financial resources to move their home to a new facility, even if they can find one. So we're looking at ways could the residents of a community have the first right to form a cooperative, to take ownership of where they live and stay in that place, to continue to work where they live and have their families with them. I think it's an exciting opportunity, and it has a great deal of, you know, humanity involved in it. Let's help people.
We have Cooperative Network President and CEO Dan Smith with us. You can join in 800-642-1234. Mike now in Wauwatosa. Mike, hi, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning. And this might be an ignorance on my part of what the cooperative really is versus another business, but where is the line drawn between business and cooperative? Because when you start talking about shared resources of housing, transportation, healthcare, that sounds to me like company town back from the 1800s and 1900s, where we were having this one overarching entity. How beholden are people within the cooperative to the cooperative, I guess? Where do people have their line drawn there?
Mike, appreciate that question. Dan?
Sure. Mike, I think the difference where you said where the line is drawn is who owned the company town. I think the company town owned by a private individual or a private entity versus the cooperative model. And the cooperative model is, governed by seven principles. And those principles are really the opposite of what we saw in the former company towns, you know, voluntary and open membership, democratic control, members economically participate in it, independence, providing education and training to the next generation, cooperation amongst cooperatives, and then concern for community. And one of the major roles at Cooperative Network is that we never forget the seven cooperative principles. That's our game plan. And I think when those are respected and in place, the risk and reward, especially the rewards of economic and social and cultural change in the community is shared by all the cooperative members.
Dan, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dan Smith is president and CEO of Cooperative Network. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with the State Department of Transportation on pressing issues in budget season. And we start with the momentum behind extending passenger rail service in the state. Join in with your questions and comments about rail, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Craig Thompson is Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Secretary Thompson, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Your department has outlined a plan to expand passenger rail service to 11 communities. Why should the state expand train service?
Well, what we've submitted is four different programs into the Corridor ID program to the federal government. And within those four, brings it to the different communities that you talked about. And what this does is it would allow us, if approved, to be in that Corridor ID program with 100% federal funding to study those routes. And so one is to increase the frequency of our current route, the Hiawatha, between Milwaukee and Chicago, which is the most popular, busiest route in the Midwest and one of the in the country. We currently have 7 round trips a day. We would like to say going to 10. Another component of that is to later this year, we're going to be launching our Twin Cities to Milwaukee to Chicago route. That will be happening, but this would be to use federal funds to study increasing the frequencies on that beyond what we're going to start with. And the third area would be increasing that Hiawatha line that currently goes between Milwaukee and Chicago to Madison, Eau Claire, in the Twin Cities eventually. And then the final portion of that would be to study also expanding that Hiawatha service to from Milwaukee to Green Bay. So a lot of different areas that we could garner federal funds for and over the next year study the feasibility and how popular those routes could be.
Let's take that one piece connecting northeastern Wisconsin to Milwaukee and Chicago by extending the Hiawatha service into the region. What needs to happen to make that a reality, and what are you hearing on the ground?
Well, we're hearing from a lot of the local elected officials in the Fox Valley, a lot of enthusiasm and support. We've gotten a lot of letters that we included in as we sent down to the federal government from mayors and local officials and county officials in the region, also including the Green Bay Packers. So there's a lot of businesses, a lot of local governments, a lot of others in the area that see that would be excited about being able to draw in more, not only visitors, but also talent and employees. So part of this program, if we get accepted into the Corridor ID program, would be that we could study the costs and what the potential ridership could be and the feasibility and all those things that could allow us to make better decisions, provide that information for our elected officials to make decisions on funding.
You mentioned the Packers, and last week the Green Bay Press Gazette reported that Amtrak is open to potentially expand service between Milwaukee and Green Bay for the 2025 NFL draft in Green Bay. With that in mind, what support do state or local governments need to offer to make expansions like that happen?
Well, I read about that Amtrak had said that too, and that was the first I was aware of it. So we do need to talk with Amtrak how that would work. If we could provide that service during the draft, that's going to be happening at Lambeau. But longer term, again, it would be doing these studies. And generally these routes are working on, it's not laying down brand new track. It's generally going along where existing track is, often owned by one of the Class One railroads, whether, you know, is Canadian Pacific or Union Pacific or Canadian National or BNSF. And a lot of times there are upgrades that may be needed, but it's working with those Class One railroads to make sure that we can operate this without negatively impacting the freight that's going on there, and looking at whatever updates may need to be made.
Our state is already connected, as you are well aware, by all these roads and highways. Why does Wisconsin need a different mode of transportation?
Well, I think if you look at a lot of the successful areas across the country, and especially right now in the labor market we have, where businesses all over are competing for the most scarce resource that's out there right now, and that's employees. The more we can do to make it easier to get folks in and from a further area away where they could actually be working, you know, there's Wi-Fi, we would have Wi-Fi on these trains. And it's just, I think it's an amenity and a mode of transportation that a lot of people are asking for. And like I said, the Hiawatha right now, between Milwaukee and Chicago, has been immensely popular and successful. So we want to study to see if these other routes would be as well.
Talking with the Department of Transportation Secretary Craig Thompson is here. You can join in with your questions. The number to call in is 800-642-1234. Looking at what needs to happen within state government, last year, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that he wouldn't support creating a passenger line from Milwaukee to Madison. Can rail services be expanded basically solely with federal funds, or would some state funding be needed?
Well, from what we've seen in the money that was included in the bipartisan infrastructure law for Amtrak, and that there's tremendous amount of federal funding available. But, you know, in all likelihood, there would need to be some state support for that. Right now, the amount of state funding that we have in for passenger rail is about a little over $6.5 million a year, which is less than 0.3% of our overall budget at the DOT. So, you know, we think there could be a reasonable amount of state funding. But in the end, it would be between our state legislature and governor, there would probably have to be some state funds allocated. And that's going to be up to, I mean, it is up to the legislature, clearly, but I think more importantly, it's up to the people, because if enough folks want this, we know our state representatives and senators listen to the people in their district. So we have a couple years to study this and have the conversation and see what the people of Wisconsin want.
Is there the political will, though? Is there the political momentum to really take Wisconsin's passenger rail and funding of it to the next level?
Well, again, I think if we do these studies and we have these conversations, there's been so much support from different areas around the state. We talked about the Fox Valley, but up in the northwestern part of the state, there's been folks that have gotten together, leaders in Eau Claire, Menominee, Baldwin, and Hudson have formed a coalition, then created the Chippewa-St. Croix Rail Commission in 2021 to try to get rail service there active again and connect themselves with the Twin Cities, you know, that huge market. So I think there's a lot of desire for it across the state. And I think over the next couple of years, we can study the feasibility of these, have these conversations. And again, I think if enough people want them, the folks that they send to Madison, I think tend to listen.
Okay, so just timeline feasibility, because you talk about the corridor identification and development program, that the corridor ID program, and the bipartisan infrastructure law creating, you know, just billions of dollars to look at these upgrades of existing rail service and, you know, market expansions, as we've been talking about around Wisconsin. What is a timeline for these exploratory funds? Where do they go next?
So we should be finding out about approval within months, I believe. And then for whatever, you know, if we get all of these approved, it would be probably over about the course of the next 2 years that we would use 100% federal funding to study each of these routes.
Let's bring on a call now. Chris in Eau Claire. Chris, hi. What would you like to ask?
Hi. So I was wondering, especially with the potential expansion of the line to cover Eau Claire and the MSP areas, what would be done to ensure that that remains affordable for folks of all income levels?
Sure. And that's a great question. And I think that's another thing that would be part of the study is to see what rates would need to be to make it successful with the amount of federal and perhaps a little bit of state funding that would be in there. And I think it would be important that that we are able to make sure that it would remain accessible to people at all income levels. So I think that's part of what the study would demonstrate and what we could show to the public before we would, actually move to dedicate those funds.
With Hiawatha service, and you say, it right now it seems to be just a very popular service. How much is it subsidized at this point?
Well, it is, there is some federal subsidy and very little bit of state dollars in there. But the fair is covering the majority of the costs, and it really has been a successful program that hasn't required a tremendous amount of subsidy.
Transportation Secretary Craig Thompson with us as we explore priority projects at the height of budget season and at the height of road construction season as well. Join in about transportation. Call in with a question for the head of the State Transportation Department, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. It's a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the next two-year state budget comes together, the state's Republican-controlled Budget Writing Committee Joint Finance removes nearly two dozen items related to transportation from Democratic Governor Tony Evers' budget proposal. Call in with questions and comments about transportation priorities and what you wonder in terms of transportation, 800-642-1234. We have Wisconsin Department of Transportation Secretary Craig Thompson with us. So the Department of Motor Vehicles launching a new driver's license design today. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, we're really excited about this. We're launching the new driver's license card. So if you go in now to buy or get your replacement driver's license, you'll see a brand new card. And they really are. Just the artwork on there, I think they're beautiful cards, but there's a lot of security features on there. In the background, you'll see the state capitol and the state flag woven throughout. And some of the different features are, as you hold it and look at it from different angles, we've got a ribbon that goes right off the edge of the card. And if you hold it at the right angle, then you're able to be able to see. If you look at it one hand, you'll see the ribbon. If you look at it another way, you'll see the month and date of your birth. And so some of this is all fully integrated into it. It is first of its kind in the country to have some of these security features. So we're really excited to launch the new card today. And if folks come in and get it, you'll notice that your driver's license or your ID card looks much different.
Why does Wisconsin need newly designed driver's licenses?
Well, again, I think a lot of what's really important about this is the new security features that we have in there. The design looks great, but this really is first of its kind in the country, security features that are embedded within these licenses, which will make it even more secure.
What will the security allow people to do, or what is the facet of the security piece of this?
Well, it would be harder to replicate, to falsely replicate these licenses. So your information will be protected more.
On Thursday, the legislature's State Budget Writing Committee is set to take up transportation funding, and lawmakers have already scrapped some of Evers' transportation proposals. What elements of the transportation budget are key, are the most important?
Well, I know they've taken some out, and we'll see what they bring up. They're going to be coming in on Thursday now for transportation, the Joint Finance Committee. And I think if we look at what this administration proposed for transportation, it really hit on the major things that are out there. There's brand new ongoing sustainable funding to continue the momentum that we've been able to build over the last 4 years on transportation, along with the federal money that we've got in. And we do it in a way that diversifies the fund. So the sales tax that on electric vehicles that generally is already coming in, we're not changing the sales tax, but rather than going into the general fund, it would go into the transportation fund. So as we have more electric vehicles on the road and less gas-powered vehicles, this would allow us to diversify where we get the revenue, and there would be natural growth to it. It also takes the growth in the sales tax and automobile-related parts and moves that into the transportation fund. So between those two, it's about $200 million in this first year of ongoing new revenues, and we think that's really important that whatever revenue we have is ongoing, predictable, and new. It also addresses safety with reckless driving. The governor proposes on the enforcement side, 35 new state troopers, and 10 new inspectors to help do enforcement on our roads, but also $60 million for local communities to be able to do different engineering to curb reckless driving, whether in an urban area to do bump outs or some road diets, or in more rural areas with rumble strips and curves and things like that. So we really think that's important as well. And then the governor takes some of that one-time money, the surplus that's out there that we talked about for one-time uses, and does something that could really help the transportation fund's fiscal condition long-term. He creates a defeasement fund. So what that means is we take about $379 million of that one-time money, put it into an eight-year schedule. When we have debt service come due, it's paid for out of this fund rather than out of the transportation fund that could be going to improve our different modes of transportation. So for this year, 2 year biennium alone, it would free up $76 million to be able to go into roads and bridges and transit and ports and other things rather than to be paying off debt service. So those are really the areas that I would hope, to me, they're very sound proposals, and I hope the legislature looks at them very closely.
Let's bring on another call, Jeff in Superior. Jeff, what do you want to ask about?
Good morning. You know, we're rebuilding the Blodnick Bridge up here in Superior between Duluth and Superior. I was wondering if you could tell me about where we're at with the project, and are you coming up here to have a town hall meeting of sort to educate us to the plan?
Sure, absolutely. I would say probably the Blodnick Bridge is the biggest project that we have upcoming, and we're going to be doing plenty of public outreach on that. It is a joint Minnesota-Wisconsin project. It's the bridge that connects Duluth and Superior. Several years ago, we were able to get the President of the United States up there. We showed him the bridge. We've got a joint application in with Minnesota to the federal government. We're asking for $800 million to help with that bridge. And we're very hopeful that we could be successful in our request for some federal funds. But we are moving forward with Minnesota. We will have plenty of public outreach on that. And that is just a hugely important project that's coming up here in Wisconsin.
Will it be slowed down because you're trying to work across state lines in order to get a major piece of of infrastructure done?
Well, you know, we have some history with this. We've got a great relationship with our neighbors in Minnesota. Commissioner Dobenberger and I talk a lot, but the St. Croix crossing over in the St. Croix area between Minnesota and Wisconsin was a joint venture just like this. And we worked together with Minnesota to get that beautiful bridge done, and I'm confident we'll be able to work together in Minnesota to get this one done as well.
And what about communication lines to local residents and how they will be updated?
Yeah, we are, that's significantly important. We are doing everything we can to reach out right now, be talking to local businesses, local homeowners, landowners, and not only hosting meetings, but trying to go out and meet people where they're at and have conversations so that they're fully aware of everything that will be transpiring in the upcoming years.
Talking with Department of Transportation Secretary Craig Thompson, fielding your questions about transportation and infrastructure projects, 800-642-1234. So in August, last time we talked, you had said construction bids were coming in 11% higher than expected, and in previous years, projects were finishing under expected costs. Are higher prices continuing this year?
They leveled off since we last talked, Kate, but they are still higher than they had been prior to that. So we still have seen it come in a little bit above, but most of the areas, diesel and steel, a lot of them have plateaued. Some of the supply chain things have gotten better. So it's leveled off, but we did have 2 years there of very high prices.
many drivers are seeing bright orange cones all over the place in construction season. Are there enough workforce crews out there in order to get these jobs done in a timely fashion?
You know, workforce is a question all across the country, but right now, as far as being able to get these projects done, our private sector partners and workforce, we do have the resources to be able to. We have not had to delay a single project yet.
Not had to delay a single project. You mentioned earlier a bit about traffic calming and the issues around reckless driving. Joint Finance, the legislature's budget writing committee, removed a proposal by Governor Evers to fund grants aimed at calming traffic and improving safety. What is your reaction to the removal of funding for those types of grants?
Yeah, I really hope that they don't simply remove it. If they want to look at it and maybe make some changes or some ways that they want to improve it. But reckless driving since the pandemic has been up really epidemic levels across the entire country. And, you know, here in Wisconsin, back in 2019, our state patrol here issued 583 citations for people going in excess of 100 miles per hour. In 2020, after the pandemic hit and, you know, traffic was down at that time, it went up to almost over 1,500 citations. It almost tripled. And we've seen it stay at very high levels. And we've seen this on our interstates, but we also see it in our cities where reckless driving has cost way too many lives. And so, you know, I know folks say we need to deal with it enforcement. The governor put in new troopers for enforcement, so we are looking at that. But we need to look at all hands on deck from every area. In engineering, we always talk about education, engineering, and enforcement are the three areas that can improve safety. And engineering is absolutely a component of that. And we've seen that these traffic calming engineering changes work. So I'm really hoping that the legislature, when they meet on Thursday, the Joint Finance Committee, that they don't simply discard that and that they think about the safety of the people of Wisconsin.
I want to land here less than a minute to go on where we're at with electrification and charging stations and what you see in the next 2-year budget plan in that regard.
Sure. Well, we're really excited. We've sent in our plan to the feds that was approved. So we're getting $78 million over the next 5 years to be able to put charging stations, 62 locations we've identified, no more than every 50 miles along our alternative fuel corridors, no more than a mile off, which is all of our interstates, Highway 2, Highway 8, Highway 29, 141 going up the northeast part of the state. So we're really excited to get moving on that. We do need a piece of legislation at the state level to be able to allow non-utilities to sell by the kilowatt hour, but we're confident we'll get that, and we're going to start being able to deploy these fast chargers out across the entire state.
Secretary Thompson, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Craig Thompson is Secretary of the State Department of Transportation. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.